Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this fine day of March 2nd, 2015. What a delight to have you all here, people who are interested in rail lines. I do need to step out as soon as I open this informational hearing and go testify on a bill really quickly. I will be back shortly, but I will open this informational hearing. And I believe the first that we have on our agenda today are Mr. Gard, the Rail and Transit Division Administrator from ODOT. Mr. Gard, thank you so much for being here. I'm going to hand the gavel over to my vice chair, and I will be back momentarily.
Thank you very much.
Educate them well while I'm gone.
Well, my very best. So, Vice Chair Davis, members of the committee, my name is Hal Gard. I am the Rail and Public Transit Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. My goal here today is really just to provide a very brief overview of the freight rail network in the state of Oregon. I don't want to take anything away from the other presenters as they come along. They'll have a much more detail. But Oregon's rail system is part of a critical interconnected system that links the United States, Canada, Mexico, and through our marine ports, actually most of the Pacific Rim and the rest of the world. It's critical to our state's economy. Most of our economy is really dependent upon the efficient movement of goods across the state, as well as people. Most of our rail network was built over a 60-year period, starting in 1870 and actually culminating about 1930. Since 1930s, we've actually been actively losing rail lines, basically through a change in economy and technology. As our road network developed, we've lost about a third of our total miles. We currently have about 2,364 miles of rail left in the state right now. That series of rail line are connected by a series of fixed assets. There are rail yards, intermodal facilities, 67 tunnels, and untowards hundreds of bridges that traverse across the state and help the trains move across a pretty rugged landscape. 87% of the network is privately owned. The remainder is owned by a series of public entities. There are three counties. In Union, Wallowa, and Lake County own their own railroads. There are two port districts, Tillamook and Coos Bay, and the city of Prineville has owned and operated their own short line railroad continuously since 1918. The two largest railroads in the western U.S., Union Pacific Railroad and the BNSF, they operate 47% of the system within Oregon, and the remaining 53% is controlled by 21 individual short lines. UP and BNSF are considered Class 1 railroads by the Federal Surface Transportation Board, and that classification is based upon gross revenue, and the remainder of the short lines are all Class 3 railroads within the state. Three of Oregon's short lines are all owned by a Connecticut-based conglomerate, Genesee and Wyoming. And they, together, that group, that conglomeration, is Portland and Western, Willamette and Pacific, and the Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad. So those are all under the same ownership of Genesee and Wyoming. The short lines, they operate the critical secondary rail network. They provide a very important collector and feeder and consolidation role for the Class 1 railroads. And for most of the communities, the short line railroads are really the face of rail for those communities. It's where most of the interaction happens and as they move along. The vast majority of the freight traffic, however, moves on the two big Class 1s. In 2013, those two railroads combined moved over 1.25 million carloads within the state, so in that 1 year. Efficient and reliable rail transportation is important. I think everybody knows that. It's really the conduit for economic and job growth, especially for businesses that are very common in this state that move large quantities of goods, so lumber, agriculture, steel, manufacturing, those type of products. The rail system fosters mode choice, and it relieves congestion on our highways. Availability of freight provides alternatives for users, and it helps hold down overall freight transportation costs by competing with the other modes. Principally, highway trucking is the main competitor, although there are also the trucking companies or the largest customers for railroads in many cases. Likewise, removing freight vehicles from the roads yields positive results not just by reducing congestion, but also reducing wear and tear on the roads. Any single rail car can hold 115 tons or equal to three or four trucks, depending upon their overall size. So that's each rail car can move that many trucks off the road. I think everybody's heard this, but relative to other modes, rail is a lot more efficient with regard to fuel consumption. And the estimate, I think everybody's heard this quote, is that a railroad can move a ton of freight an average of 473 miles on a single gallon of fuel. So also, in terms of greenhouse emissions, rail transport of freight reduces greenhouse emissions by 75%. As I mentioned earlier, a well-coordinated rail system enhances community quality of life, and preservation of rail corridors ensures that communities have the opportunity to develop freight-served economies in the future or freight-served businesses in the future. That's why we worry when we lose a short line, because that opportunity frequently is not able to come back if that short line closes down. In Oregon, as in most of the United States, with the exception of the Northeast Corridor, the freight rail system provides the added public benefit by accommodating our Amtrak intercity passenger rail. The primary north-south corridor in Oregon, it's fundamental to the interstate traffic of passengers. And passenger trains are really dependent upon really high-quality track in order to maintain time and schedule and speeds as they move up and down the line. And, of course, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe also provides that service in an east-west route, the Empire Builder that heads all the way out to Chicago. We, as a state, we actively collaborate with regional and local governments and the private rail companies to plan and explore future investments. Connect Oregon, in the first four iterations, we've invested $146 million in railroad projects, but we've leveraged $85 million in private investments. And the rail, I think, has been exceptionally successful with the Connect Oregon projects because they frequently are able to overmatch the 20% required match for the state grants. There are several federal rail fund programs that exist, but we generally are not able to take advantage of them. The only time we can apply for a Tiger grant, which is transportation investments generating economic recovery grants, is if we can get a railroad to provide the matching money. We have no source of state match for any of the other federal programs available. So if it's a short time or a quick return on a grant application, we frequently see that money go to other states instead of us retaining it in the state of Oregon. And I think with that, I am going to close my remarks. I'm happy to entertain any questions or turn it over to our other
questions from
presenters.
The committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, now we'll call up our second panel, Mr. Nelson and Mr. Hellman. Gotcha. Mr. Nelson, you look quite different today.
I grew hair.
I was looking forward to seeing two guys who looked a lot like me up there.
So do you just click on this to make it go?
The arrow should advance it.
You scroll down the middle button.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent Union Pacific Railroad. Thank you for allowing me to sit in for Brock Nelson at the last moment today. He did have an emergency to attend to out in the eastern Oregon. Union Pacific Railway is created more than 150 years ago when Abraham Lincoln signed the Pacific Railway Act of July 1st, 1862. And with that historic stroke of the pen, he opened up the West Coast to be part of the continent and receive both people and freight from across America. Today, UP serves 23 states. In Oregon, we move, as you can see here, both north-south and east-west. Nationally, we have about 32,000 miles of track and 45,000 employees. But in Oregon, we have about 1,073 miles of track and about 1,600 employees. And our track is also used by both the short line and passenger railways in Oregon. for Union Pacific. Safety is the number one concern, and I really, when I first started working for UP 10 years ago, I was surprised how many times it says safety is our number one concern. And every time I went to a meeting, we had a safety instruction on that meeting. And it truly is their number one concern, both for their equipment and their capital and their people. You can see in this chart that the Rail's dedication to safety has led to steep declines in accidents in the last few years. And bridge and track inspections are an important part of making sure that all our capital is safe. And you'll see here that 20 million track site evaluations are done per day to make sure our 23 state corridors are safe. Besides equipment, track, and infrastructure, we also make safety number one when it comes to our people. First responder training is a very important part of our preparation. We've identified 38 fire departments along our rail corridors in Oregon. We provide comprehensive training to these fire departments as well as to other first responders around the state. We recently did such a training in Baker City for 60 employees, and in the last 3 years, we have trained 1,280 first responders in Oregon in case there is an accident that they need to respond to. So what are we hauling? As you can see, the largest sector for intermodal freight cars. In Oregon in 2013, the top three commodities shipped were intermodal cars, lumber, building materials, and paper. And the three top commodities received that came in were intermodal recyclables and soda ash. I had to figure out what soda ash was used for. I thought maybe it was roads, but it's for glass, detergents, other chemical and industrial materials. You can see, as we look here, we'll see that coal seems rather large here, but actually in Oregon, UP only brings coal into the Boardman plant. It does not come across our state. You can see here our intermodal corridors throughout the United States. UP can move one ton of freight 480 miles on a single gallon of diesel fuel. That's generating a carbon footprint that is 75% less than that of a truck. Locomotive fuel accounts for our largest impact on greenhouse gas emissions, but since 2000, UP has achieved a 19% improvement in fuel efficiency. We've spent nearly $6.5 billion to purchase 3,700 new, cleaner locomotives. We're really proud of that and the work that we've done both on safer cars and cleaner locomotives.
Ms. Robert, yes. What are you fueling your locomotives on, the new, cleaner? What's the difference between the old and the new?
I'm happy to provide you with some of that information. I know that some of it is actually that we use some biodiesel. In Oregon, we use biodiesel all the way from level 1 to level 5, the highest level. In Eugene, we're using the higher biodiesel. So we are running on alternative fuel.
Great. Thank you.
Let's see. This here is what we've spent in the last 12 or so years on infrastructure, locomotives, facilities, technologies, and positive train control. You'll remember when positive train control first came into existence, it was a way for us to use high technology from far away to control our trains and their movement, especially to stop and slow trains from a distance. Here's how that kind of breaks down. You'll see that almost half of what we spend is on infrastructure replacement. And so these are some of the projects that we have done in Oregon of recent. UP is proud to be a responsible partner in Oregon, and I'll answer any questions I can. And if I can't, I'll get Brock to do it when he gets back.
Any questions? You know, Ms. Robert, I have a question, and this may not apply. It may apply to all of you. I was down at L.A. Long Beach not too long ago, and they were using some hybrid locomotives. They were relatively new at that time. I'm sure they were, I don't know if they were prototypes. They were actually on the market. But is there any conversation about the hybrid locomotives in your industry, that this is something that we might be looking for, or a different type of fueling?
Madam Chair, I think that you might be talking about some of the genset locomotives. That might be where. So was it for switching in yards, or was it going down the?
These were switching in
yards. Yeah. So that's part of the genset switchers, and we use the ultra low emissions EPA certified off road diesel engines, and the gensets actually reduce the use of fuel by 37%. And right now we're using those in most of our yards.
And BNSF is experimenting with locomotives that would run on liquefied natural gas. It's just in a pilot project stage right now. But we're always looking at how we can use alternative fuels because, you know, diesel consumption is such a major concern in our industry. We're always looking for a way to do that more efficiently and more effectively.
So an LNG fueling would require a tender car of some sort?
Correct.
Yeah, and those are actually in operation now as a test?
We're testing different LNG technologies right now.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chair. So I just have a question regarding, I see your list of capacity projects, but I know one of the big interests, I'm a person that rides the passenger train line, so I know one of the big interests is the dual tracks in that, so there isn't the conflicts or having to wait for it. So I wonder, is there a long-term plan? I know Washington has a much more extensive system of dual tracks than we do in Oregon. So is there a long-term plan and estimates of what it would cost for Oregon to end up more with that type of system?
Madam Chair, Representative Lively, Union Pacific and BNSF have both been very involved in the whole rail planning and the passenger rail conversation that's going on in Oregon for a number of years. Unfortunately, I don't think that group has come to a decision on how best to do a double track, especially from your area up here, which is an idea that a lot of them have as a vision for the future. But I don't think they've come up with a way to do that yet. We've looked at lots of different routes and lots of different capacities as far as buying or renting or using abandoned lines, but so far nothing has come to fruition.
Thank you.
Please.
Okay. We're waiting for the BNSF presentation to come up on the screen.
It might be hard pressed to speak to the UP, I'm guessing. We won't ask you to do that.
Well, that could be entertaining.
I think we're on the technological level.
Oh, this is it, yeah.
Okay.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Madam. Thank you, staff, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Johan Hellman, and I'm the Executive Director of Government Affairs for BNSF here in the Pacific Northwest. There have been a lot of questions about rail, particularly about capacity, issues of safety. I'll touch on these briefly during my comments and also reiterate some of the same themes as you heard in the presentation from UP. We've been operating, actually, in the Pacific Northwest in different forms for more than 100 years, and we trace our lineage back to six legendary railroads, including the Northern Pacific, the Great Northern Railway, the Spokane, Portland, and Seattle, the Frisco, the Santa Fe, and the Burlington route. In terms of our national network, we're divided into three main segments. That Mid-Con section, the group of tracks running north and south from Canada down to the Gulf, that's known as the Mid-Con. Running through the southwest part of the United States is the Trans-Con. And then the part that we're most interested in here in the Pacific Northwest is the Great Northern Corridor, also known as the High Line, which runs along the northern tier of the United States. In terms of our network, we operate 32,000 miles of track over 28 states and two Canadian provinces. We have more than 48,000 employees and serve more than 40 ports and 30 intermodal facilities. On average, we move about 1,600 trains a day on our network, and last year we shipped more than 10 million carloads of freight. Each year we move enough grain to supply 900 million people with their daily bread, enough lumber to make more than 500,000 homes. And during an average holiday season, we move about 5 million packages, and we're proud to say that we deliver those on time. And it's interesting because, you know, when you buy something, say, on Amazon, and then you have that tracker, you can watch it go across the United States, a lot of times that's moving on a train. I just add this because it's an example of how trains and railroads are the 19th century technology that are critical to the 21st century economy, or as we say, are the original internet. We're also, as you heard, the most environmentally friendly mode of surface transportation.
Took a minute.
We move a ton of freight, 500 miles on a single gallon of fuel. That number has actually escalated a little bit. I think that Hal said it was 475, and then Cindy said 480. On our railroad, we're running at about 500, so proud to say that. In terms of our network here in Oregon, we enter the Northwest through the Idaho-Washington border and then go along on the northern side of the Columbia River, the Washington state side. We drop down into Portland, serve the Port of Portland and other industrial and manufacturing customers there, but the bulk of our network runs down through what's known as the Oregon Trunk. as I said, for more than a century, we've played an important role in Oregon's economy. It's part of the Great Northern Corridor, as I said, and which spans the Pacific Northwest to Chicago. We help to connect Oregon businesses to markets within the United States, Canada, and around the world. And in all, we move more than 320,000 carloads of freight in Oregon annually. Supporting BNSF's rail operations in Oregon are more than 360 dedicated employees who earn a combined payroll of more than $25 million for an average salary of about $70,000 per year. I'm going to talk a little bit about capacity because there's been some speculation about that, and I think the facts are pretty compelling. If you go back and you look historically, peak years on the railroad generally are thought of as being about 2006. That was when the economy was really running full strength. You had a lot of shipping going to Asia. The ports were very busy doing a lot of intermodal traffic. With the recession, that dipped down, and it's come back to where we're quickly approaching the same levels that we saw in 2006. But what I think is interesting to note is that the commodity mix has changed substantially since then. As I said earlier, in 2006, we were moving a lot of international intermodal traffic. It was about 30% of our total commodity mix. If you fast forward to 2013, and this has been consistent over 2014 as well, that's only about 23% of our commodity mix. And a lot of that has been replaced by domestic intermodal. This is an example of how the transportation sector kind of works and interacts. Because trucks are moving less freight long haul, a lot of that has been taken over by the railroads. The other thing is that with unit train movements being so efficient and so desirable, you've had a shifting to where you'll do more truck traffic locally to get to an intermodal yard, sort of a hub facility, and then you'll put that on a train and send it, say, to Chicago. So there's been a little bit of a shift as a result of that. Coal has been about the same for us. It's actually a little bit less. Agriculture maintains about the same. The last couple of years, we've seen bumper crops on some agricultural commodities, so that's bumped up a little bit. But agriculture is pretty consistent on our lines. Carload is kind of that general boxcar, which has stayed about the same. It's actually diminishing a little bit just because of efficiencies, market efficiencies within the company. And then petroleum. If you look at 2006, it was only about 1% of our commodity mix. We didn't move our first unit train of crude until 2009, so that's why. I mean, there was a very quick ramp up. But if you look, it's still 5% or less of our total commodity mix. Sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, you know, all they want to do is run petroleum or coal. And if you look statistically, that's really not the case. The case is that it's less than 5%, and that's consistent in our moves through the Pacific Northwest as well. Well, as I said, the capacity piece kind of hit a choke point a little bit after the recession, and a couple of things happened. The industrial sector was hit especially hard during the last recession. And so the trough that the industrial sector went into was much deeper. When it came back, it rebounded more quickly. So you had this kind of shock to the system. And with the commodity mix changing and supply chains shifting, everything was kind of put a little bit askew at the railroad for a couple of years. And from our perspective, the only way out of it was really to buy our way out by building in additional capacity, by trying to do some additional double tracking, by creating opportunities to move things around our network more efficiently and make up for those places where there were deficiencies. And so we've spent record amounts the last 3 years. Going back to 2013, our annual capital expenditures was $4 billion. Last year, we spent $5.5 billion, and this year we're on track to spend $6 billion. Like I said, our network through Oregon is fairly limited, but I can get you more specific numbers about what that means for our investment in Oregon this year as well. Looking back at our $5.5 billion 2014 capital program, we made 3.6.
1 second, please. Oh, Representative Benz.
I think I'm sure. Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
So how much of that is driven by oil, do you think? Oil trains? Very much, or is that pretty much all driven by the rapid rebound of the economy?
I would say it's all driven by the rapid rebound of the economy. I mean, I think intelligent people could argue it in different ways, but in our approach, it's always about efficiency and velocity and maximizing our network. We're not looking at specific commodities and thinking, okay, well, how are we going to make that investment? Because that's a very short-term aspect. We make long-term investments. When you look at rail infrastructure, it lasts for decades. Our bridges, some of them out there, are 100 years old. And so we're always looking. They're not much to look at, maybe, but they're certainly, from an engineering standpoint, they're actually over-engineered. So we're looking at the long term, and you really can't base that kind of investment on a commodity-by-commodity approach.
follow-up, Manager?
Yes, sir.
But it would be really interesting to see what it is that you anticipate is going to be your big business driver over the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Perhaps you can show that to us.
Well, I don't have a slide that shows that specifically, but what I can tell you is that in my conversations with senior management, commodity traffic tends to change. I mean, the first rule of predicting commodities is that commodities are fundamentally unpredictable. So if you look across over the long term at what drives the railroad, certain commodities, agriculture, intermodal traffic a lot, especially in the modern era, is moving it. And we think that international intermodal piece will probably be a more significant piece going forward. It's just going to take a little bit of time for those supply chains to equal out. So I think if you look at the last decade or few decades at the things that have driven the railroad, those will continue to drive the railroad in the future as well. And a lot of that, like I said, is intermodal traffic, specific commodities like agriculture, building supplies, things like that.
Hello, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
We'd almost have to look at not only your system but others to compare, but if we did, would we see a similar investment across the range of railroads in general?
Yeah, I think that the numbers that Cindy showed were fairly comparable to ours. We're investing more because I think that we just have the resources to be able to do that. As a Berkshire Hathaway company, we have a little bit more flexibility to be able to do that. But I think that it's consistent across the sector that railroad recognizes its piece in economic development and is investing aggressively for that. And the thing is, too, it's important to note that we move everything. Any major commodity that moves over land is probably moving on a railroad. Within ours, we say we move everything from apples to zebras, which is really true. We move, Washington State apples so that they can get out to international markets. And we also, move things for the circus when they come through areas, too. And everything in between, lumber, supplies, agriculture, soybeans.
But this is thank you for your indulgence. I just have to say it looks as though this is a more – just look at your chart there. It looks like it actually exceeds the average there by a bunch. And I'm just trying to figure out what it is that's driving that. Either you're further behind and you're now trying to catch up, or something else is driving that. It looks like almost out of the ordinary increase, but I could be wrong. But I'm taking a wild guess. Does the expansion of the Panama Canal have anything to do with you guys' anticipation of what that's going to do to freight and its movement across the United States?
I can't answer that question. I don't know that that's part of our projections. It very well could be. I just don't know.
Mr. Okay. Hillman, when I look at the 2015 projected, though, it looks to me as though replacement is a big portion of, the red line across the bottom. So are you replacing aging infrastructure or aging rolling stock? When you say replacement capital, what are you referring to?
Yeah, we're replacing old track. We're replacing old ties so that our system is working more efficiently. We're also replacing old locomotives, although we made quite an investment this last year in new locomotives. We invested in about 600 locomotives this last year. So even though we will be bringing some additional ones online in 2015, I think we're starting to cap out on that.
So part of that's expansion, but the replacement piece has to do with age.
Yeah, yeah. I can actually address that a little bit in future slides, actually, as well, too, the replacement piece.
Anything further, Representative Benz?
No.
All right.
Yeah. For the moment.
Thank you.
So going back to 2014, we spent $5.5 billion last year. That included about $3.6 in additional capacity. Expansion capital. Like I said, we brought on 600 new locomotives. We also hired 7,000 additional people. One of the things that really drove a lot of investment last year and this year was that we had some severe weather events in the Midwest. And I was actually in Fort Worth when one of these events happened. And the question was asked, it was about negative 15 in a snowstorm in Minnesota. And the question was asked, what doesn't work when it's negative 15? The answer is nothing works when it's negative 15. And one of the challenges that you get into is that you have to start shortening the trains, which means that your power is distributed differently, which means the network's not moving very efficiently, which means that you're stranding gear and you're stranding individuals. And so part of the way that we responded to that, and it goes a little bit to the question that was asked by Representative Benz about why we're spending so much locally, is to try to get those efficiencies up so that we're moving things more efficiently so that we can move all of those commodities and meet the service needs of our clients. That was one of the big things that was a big concern over the last couple of years, is that the service just wasn't there in the way that folks had traditionally expected from our railroad. This goes a little bit to the importance of investing. There's actually a direct proportion between the amount of money that a railroad invests in infrastructure and the track-caused accident rate. So we're always trying to keep our track particularly as up-to-date, as current, as modern as we can keep it. Because one, it increases safety, and two, it increases velocity. So it would be very similar to road infrastructure. If you have roads with potholes, it's making them less safe. It's making them less efficient. If you have newer roads, it makes the roads move that much more quickly. The biggest concern for us in terms of safety is preventing accidents in the first place. And I will say that rail transportation, if you look at other industrial and manufacturing services, is actually quite a bit safer than other ones by far. If you compare it to something like mining or transportation or even air transportation, which most of us kind of take for granted, the incident rates on the railroads are much less. And BNSF is an industry leader. 2014 was our safest year in history. You can see a consistent downward trend. Since 1980, rates for accidents, employee injury, crossing, collisions fell by more than 80%. As I said, 2014 was the safest year in history for the rail industry, according to the Federal Rail Administration records. Rail, as I said, is the safest mode of land transportation for freight in general and is one of the safest ways to transport hazardous materials specifically, which is part of the reason why federal statute and regulation requires us to move these materials in concert with our common carrier obligation. Talk briefly about our specific safety program. We inspect tracks and bridges at twice the frequency required by the Federal Railroad Administration. Most of our key routes where hazmat trains run are inspected four times per week, more than twice the inspection frequency required by the federal government. Our busiest main lines are inspected daily. Track inspections on BNSF main lines occur by high rail vehicle, in addition to the normal high rail inspections. On-foot inspections of all turnouts on the main lines and yard tracks are required at least monthly, and supervisors are also required to make regular train rides over their assigned territories. Track inspectors record track conditions and update data following each inspection, and this information is provided to the Federal Railroad Administration. To prioritize track surfacing, we have a fleet of dedicated track geometry cars that traverse our network on an ongoing basis, collecting data about the condition of our 32,000-mile network. We run all this data through an algorithm to generate a track quality index. And we also use ultrasonic rays to detect internal and external flaws in the rail. And the frequency of inspections is determined by the tonnage moved over a given section of track. But as I said earlier, we inspect our main line consistently, and the main line routes receive rail detector testing about every 30 to 50 days on average. We also have a variety of trackside detectors. These include wheel impact detectors that measure forces applied to the rail to evaluate wheel surface defects. We have hot boxes that determine if a bearing is heating up, which could be a precursor to a truck particularly giving out. They're measuring any auditory signals that might be going off that indicates that car is behaving erratically. And when that's identified, we move that train off to the side, take out whatever those cars might be so that we can continue that in a safe way. These particular boxes are located about every 40 miles along our track, except in key areas like along the Columbia River Gorge. We've actually shortened that distance to about 17 to 20 miles. This is our Network Operations Center in Fort Worth, Texas. I just put this in here because it's important to note that all of this information about tracks and trains and where they're going is monitored in our Network Operations Center. Folks who've been there compare it to Mission Base in Houston for NASA or any of the aviation centers, NORAD perhaps. It's an absolutely gigantic facility. There's about 100 people who work on the floor. To give you a sense of scale, those blue screens that you're looking at are about 19 by 24 feet large, height by width, and there's about a dozen of them in that room. Most folks, when we're talking specifically about crew, don't understand that we don't own the rail cars that move in our railroad. Those are actually owned by shippers or leasing companies. And this is why our company and also the UP has really advocated for higher standards for these tank cars that would be moving crude oil and kind of moving away from the 111 cars. We've been advocating at the federal level for several years. There's actually a rulemaking underway right now that we think is going to have a standard that will have a higher standard of safety for tank cars. This is some additional information about that particular car. If folks have questions about it, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions about that. We think that rule is going to be issued the first quarter of this year, probably around April or May.
Questions?
Okay. We station hazmat first responders around our network. We have about 212 responders at 60 locations, including here in Oregon. We also provide free community hazmat training. We've provided this training to about 4,000 local emergency responders each year going back to 1996. We trained more than 65,000 emergency responders since then. In 2014, we participated in 28 training sessions for responders here in Oregon and Washington, training more than 1,000 people. We have specialized equipment and hazmat responders staged across our network to deal with hazmat and crude oil incidents, including firefighting and spill cleanup. Trailers are mobilized to the location of an incident, and contract industrial firefighters are deployed to operate the equipment. We have a fleet of about 16 of these on hazmat routes across our network. We have resources staged in areas including here in Oregon at Portland, Eugene, Klamath Falls, Moody, and Prineville. As I said, there's been a fair amount of activity at the federal level over the last year. These are some of the things that have come through either through executive orders or voluntary operating practices that we've agreed to with the federal government. Happy to talk more about any of those. And if there is a major event, we're responsible for the mitigation of the spill and the restoration of that. We're completely self-insured. We take that responsibility very seriously. And as an example, I can tell you that when there was a major incident in Castleton, North Dakota, we responded within 24 hours and we're issuing checks on the ground within that time frame. State agencies oversee our remediation work, and they must concur before a site is closed. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both so much for being here today. Behemoth strikes me as a term for both the companies that you represent. I mean, huge capital investments, huge operations spanning the country. What can we do in the state of Oregon to entice and encourage that investment to be drawn towards one of these 50 states, Oregon?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I'll be honest with you. Very early on in my early 10 years of working for Union Pacific, we touted Connect Oregon all over the nation. We actually started having an officer within UP called the Public-Private Partnership Officer. It was a great thing, and we looked upon it as a way not to change what we're doing in the states, because we always had a list of things we wanted to accomplish. But what it did do is it made us prioritize differently based on when we had some matching funds and when we had community interest and other partner interests in what we were doing. That kind of public-private partnership really was the cutting edge of making us want to come to Oregon and spend money here. Connect Oregon now is certainly that for a lot of people, and we have partnered with people and written support letters to a lot of folks on their projects. Now our biggest concern is just making sure that all of you are safe, and we've heard a lot from your local governments and communities on safety and making sure that they're getting the training they need and the assurances they need, and that we're updating our rail and inspecting our rail enough to keep them safe really is our number one priority, more than expanding through Connect Oregon.
Thank you. Mr. Hillman?
Yeah, I would add to that a couple of things. I think, one, it's important that our organizations, the state and the Class I railroads, are working in a partnership, communicating and sharing this kind of communication. I mean, opportunities like this are fantastic. One of the things that strikes me in my travels around the region, because I cover Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia, is the ability of the Canadians to bring new projects online very rapidly. If you look at what they've been able to do with their ports, for example, they're able to adapt and bring on new terminal projects very, very quickly, and that puts them at an incredible competitive advantage, particularly at a time when we have to look at shipping along the West Coast and also competition with Gulf states, as someone indicated earlier with the expansion of the Panama Canal. So that acceleration, that ability to expedite projects and bring them online quickly, move through permitting processes in a timely manner, that's very important as well. And I think, too, to go to what Cindy said a little bit, making those kind of investments, having that communication between our organizations to be able to look towards the future, that's all very helpful. But I have a lot of optimism for this region because I think we have tremendous assets here, tremendous opportunity, and tremendous intellectual capital that we can continue to be a great shipping, great manufacturing, great industrial, and really have, you know, fantastic port communities as well.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chairman. I don't know which one answers it, but you brought up the term unit trains.
Yeah.
And the reason I ask, or what I understand a little bit more about that, now, no disrespect to my friends that run trucks on the highway, but for me, the more we can get on the trains, the better. So I'm on your side.
Yeah.
But I have a major manufacturer in my area. When I toured recently and saw huge quantities of freight, they said they weren't able to use rail to ship that. And I can't tell you the number of trucks each day going out of the facility, but it's a large number, because they couldn't meet the standard for the number of cars they had to have daily or whatever it was. I don't know. So I'd like to understand a little bit more about unit trains or how that works. Because in looking at this facility, it's large, it's been there for years. They used to use rail. They're not today using much rail.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to understand, so what's happened or changed versus what used to go on?
Well, Representative Lively, you're exactly right. For every train, every unit train particularly that we're moving of about 100 cars, we're taking 280 trucks off the road. So, you know, that means a lot for emissions. It means a lot for traffic congestion. There's a lot of benefit to that. The challenge is that unit trains are very, very efficient, you know, and sometimes I'll get questions about, you know, people talk, you know, sort of disparagingly about unit trains. But the reality is that we all like unit trains. And the reason why is because it's a very, very efficient way of moving commodities overland. It actually goes back about 20 years to our grain shuttle program, where we found that if we could get, you know, all of the grain into one long 100-car train and move it across the countryside, we could realize tremendous efficiencies. And those efficiencies actually get translated on to the farmers as well. So it's been a very, very successful, very very successful program. The challenge is that with the evolution of railroading, you don't have the kind of traditional, you know, cargo train that goes from town to town to town and picks up boxes along the way. Back in the old days, if you imagine 50 years ago, you would put out a couple boxcars, we'd pick them up, you know, you'd go by the next town, we'd pick up three more. A couple months later, we'd show up in Chicago, and then we'd come all the way back across the country and do that again. The reality is that modern supply chains just require you to be a lot more fast-moving, a lot more accelerated than that. So the challenge there is that for someone like your local business, they may not have the ability to bring in a unit train. And so what you need is for the different pieces of the sector to work together so that we might not be able to bring a unit train into that particular location, but if you can get cargo boxes there at a regular basis and move those to an intermodal yard, say in Portland, then you can get that on a train and you can recognize some of those efficiencies. So it's not a perfect solution for everyone, but it tends to work pretty well, and it provides you locally with that flexibility to where you don't have to be in a major city, but also provides you the efficiency of being able to get that someplace quickly. And also, it gives you the flexibility to kind of be able to play different markets. If your market is the Midwest, then you want to get it on a train. But if your market is Asia, maybe you want to get it on an airplane if the prices are right. So it gives you the flexibility of being able to play either way without having to pay for the cost of getting it on a unit train.
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, Representative Lively, and actually brings a little bit of what Representative Davis was asking as well. The thing that's interesting about a manifest train, and that's what we call the trains that have different commodities, very much like Johan was just saying, it's very hard to coordinate and put all that together and make sure that that can all happen. And then you throw in the fact that we have passenger rail lines that we have to move around, and then you throw in the fact that the rail isn't all owned in the state by the same person. So there's a lot of coordinating that has to go on. We're really thankful that we have a lot of great short line system here in Oregon that, amen, makes it so that we can serve more of those people. And the more we can build upon that, the better. The communication here is key, and that's what is good for the growth and making sure we can get to some of those folks. You will notice on the chart that I sent, it is in your OLIS listing of things. You will notice that the number one, the highest ranking commodity for us, for UP, is intermodal. And that's the kind of car that Johan was talking about. One of the issues, and I'd love to come to your office and talk more because I think you're probably on our line for this certain customer. Mm-hmm. But one of the issues is, in fact, how long can their product be
sit in
the car for? And how long can it sit for? So let's talk. I look forward to that. But you do bring up a really good point, and we couldn't do it without short lines.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And there may be a short line coming to the panel in a moment that may be able to answer your question.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a simple question, and that is, how is the slowdown in Portland affecting you guys?
Well, thank you for asking. That was my next question.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, obviously, the slowdown, do you mean by a congestion, or do you mean by the port and Hanjin?
The latter.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think the effect has been fully felt yet. I think that we'll see that effect more as they actually pull out. We're moving the cars right now, so.
It's obviously a major concern. Before I came to BNSF, I worked for the Ports Association in Washington State. So I really, you know, come from a ports background. As Cindy said, I don't think that we've fully recognized the impact that it has had yet. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how supply chains have shifted, because that was one of my big concerns coming from a ports background. Once you disrupt that movement for a period of time and that supply chain shifts, it's very, very difficult to bring it back again, and I don't think we've recognized that.
Right. Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
And that's exactly where I was going with this, on the $5 billion or $6 billion you guys are investing. One would think you'd be taking into account where you're going to be going and what the likelihood is of disruptions, given all of the discussion we had about unit trains, which is a very, very hot topic in my area, because we are a long ways from the RailX in Tri-Cities, and a lot of talk about maybe a RailX in Idaho, and I mean, just a lot of talk about freight. So it's, but you guys are kind of beyond talk. You're kind of into that investment piece, and I'm worried that you may already be making plans to circle Oregon, which is one of the reasons we worked so hard on the Columbia River crossing bill. Yeah. Sadly, it was not successful. But the point is, that has consequences. And what I'm really asking the two of you is, what are they? And to the extent you can share them. And it would be nice to know if those failures on our part, whether they be at the port or whether they be on the bridge or wherever they are, how are they playing out in you guys' rooms when you sit down and plan where you're going to invest your billions?
Well, we spent more than $550 billion in the Pacific Northwest in the last 3 years. So we continue to invest very aggressively in the Pacific Northwest. And I think that, to your point, the gateway and the corridor live and die together. I mean, they're just absolutely interlinked. The rail needs the ships need the rail, the ports, all of that activity. And, you know, the agriculture and manufacturing and industry, they all play into that as well. As I said earlier, we make our investments on the long term. We're looking decades along, and as we look out over several decades, we still think that there's going to be robust trade through the Pacific Northwest. What exactly it looks like, how exactly that manifests itself, we really don't know. But with all of the opportunity, with all the port districts, with everything that we've got in the Northwest, there's still a lot of opportunity to move forward, so we're optimistic about that. But you're exactly right. There are going to be short-term obstacles that we need to overcome, and they're going to be very challenging, and I don't think we really know how we're going to overcome those at this point yet.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, sir.
I'm very happy to say that there's still hope. I think that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and great optimism.
Madam Chair, and Representative Bentz, I think clearly something will replace it. Something, the port has to deliver something, and we will deliver it from the port. And we will keep the infrastructure capable of doing so. And does that mean it's going to be a commodity no one likes? No, absolutely not. It's going to be something that works for all of us, the port, the rail, and the people. And we're confident that we'll keep the infrastructure exactly where it needs to be, and we'll have some adjustments to make in the short term, but in the long term will be just as strong.
And dare I say, it may open capacity for Representative Lively's customer.
There you go.
Let's get going. I don't know. Maybe there's more room.
And a whole new terminal.
A whole other terminal.
Yeah.
That's right.
Thank you so much for your time. We greatly appreciate you coming down and talking to us today. Our next panel, we have, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, Mr. Hoff. My apologies, Mr. Hoff. Carla Grolu and Scott Parkinson. Thank you.
Railroad Day.
It's Railroad Day. Yes. Mr. Hoff, we have you up first, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us. Representatives, my name is Kevin Hoff. I'm the general manager of the Portland Western railroad here. And we want to thank you for letting us come and talk about the Genesee and Wyoming systems, and more importantly, our operations in the state of Oregon.
And I'm Carla Grillo. Thank you also for having me. I'm also with Kevin, Genesee and Wyoming.
Thank you.
And in the Government Affairs Department.
It's hard to believe that in 1899, Genesee and Wyoming was founded as a 14-mile railroad serving a single customer in upstate New York. Today, we have worldwide operations that span the United States, Australia, and Netherlands. We own or operate 116 railroads with more than 15,000 track miles. We employ more than 5,200 people. We have more than 1,000 locomotives. We move more than 2 million carloads annually, and we've added 98 railroads to the network since 2000. But the important thing to understand is we are not a Class 1 railroad. We are not Union Pacific, and we are not Burlington Northern. The Pacific region is one of 11 operating regions on the Genesee and Wyoming network. It's headquartered in Salem, Oregon, and consists of two short line railroads in Washington. We'll say two short line railroads in Oregon. The Portland Western is made up of both the Portland Western and the Willamette and Pacific. And then there's two more railroads in Northern California. More than 250 total employees on the Pacific region that runs, or excuse me, in the state of Oregon, running from the northernmost border all the way to the southern. America's short lines and regional railroads operate nearly 30% of the nation's total railroad mileage and bring efficient, reliable rail service to communities that would otherwise have no connection to the markets. The Portland Western Railroad started out in 1993. We are headquartered in Salem, Oregon. We have more than 512 track miles, and we are the second largest freight railroad in the state of Oregon, with interchanges with the Albany and Eastern Railroad, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Central Oregon and Pacific, the Coos Bay Rail Link, and the Union Pacific Railroad.
And I would just say that in many cases, we are the short line is that providing the first mile and last mile of service that plays that critical, important role.
Additionally, we operate the West Passenger Network from Wilsonville to Beaverton, which connects into the TriMet transportation system. The Central Oregon and Pacific is our southern railroad. I'm not as familiar with that one, but we'll tell you a little bit about it. It does have 303 operating mainline miles. Lumber and related products are the mainstay of the railroad. They employ 54 people, have 12 locomotives, and one of the big projects going on in 2015 is the Siskiyou project, which is still on target for completion this year. G&W has been recognized as a rail leader in safety. Overall, the entire Genesee and Wyoming system had better safety performance than our Class 1 partners, better than the entire group of FRA Class 2 railroads or Class 3. Safety is never fixed, and we're committed to continuous improvement. And our goal every day is that our regions will be injury-free. A side note, the Pacific region far exceeded what the Genesee and Wyoming number was in 2014 with a 0.22 index, and the Pacific region was also named the most improved Genesee and Wyoming region for safety and the President's Award winner for 2014.
Oregon operations are also very active in Operation Lifesaver, nonprofit organization that goes out and does safety presentations on railroad crossing safety and other safety issues. Our employees here locally presented to more than 2,500 of those students and other folks throughout the state.
And as in any business, our success is what our customers think of us. We do a survey every year across Genesee and Wyoming. The latest results for 2013 showed that Genesee and Wyoming was had better customer satisfaction than the overall trucking industry and the railroad industry, and that the things that our customers valued the most was our commitment to safety and our professionalism. We are a huge believer in public-private partnerships. Connect Oregon and Tiger Grants have been a significant part of our Oregon operations. One of those projects on the Central Oregon on the Corp was the Tunnel Enhancement Project, which had these old tunnels that through the partnerships were able to make a number of changes and expansions. As of 2015, the Corp Tunnel Project is complete, and the impacted customers from this have grown their business 26% on a year-over-year basis.
Mr. Hoff, did that?
Yes.
Could you go back one slide?
Yes. Hopefully.
Is the date on that 1925?
Yes, I believe
it is. On that tunnel? Mm-hmm. So that gives you a sense of the age of some of the infrastructure that we deal with in Oregon?
Absolutely. And to echo what the BN and the UP said, we operate over many bridges that are 100 years or more old.
And where is this located?
I'm not that familiar with the Corp, so it's going to be somewhere in Central Oregon.
The exterior has the data. If the tunnel, the next slide is the interior, it looks like it's near Glendale.
It's somewhere Medford. Between Glendale and Medford.
It's on the, okay.
Yeah, that's where the project was between Glendale and Medford.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. And on the Portland and Western, we highlighted one project that was a little bit different. This was one that was done with a major customer. It also includes Weyerhaeuser, one of our major shippers. And up in Rainier, we were able to extend into two rail spurs, and by being able to do this with a Connect Oregon project, we were able to remove spotting this customer during the daylight time to where we only spot them between midnight and 5. We can do that one time per day. It increased the customer's overall efficiency because they weren't having to wait for the railroad to do a number of spots throughout the day of logs and lumber. It also significantly reduced the noise and idle train time in the area. It opened up the daytime for the vehicular traffic in the community that we were traveling through out there along Highway 30.
Mr. Huff, could you give us a sense of what 1,500 feet of rail spur costs?
Well, of course, if it's just somewhat shovel ready, it's about $1.5 million a mile anymore for new construction. So divide that by about 3, so about $500,000.
Thank you.
It's very expensive.
We brought these to light because we thought they showed the good partnership between ODOT, our business, and, of course, our customers.
Right. One of the other commitments that was made in 2014 was expanding and bringing the full dispatch center from Albany up to Salem. It operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and currently they're dispatching 7 different railroads in 4 states, Oregon, Washington, California, and Virginia. They dispatch over 1,900 track miles and more than 90 to 100 trains a day. And if anybody cares to come down and have a tour of that, we'd welcome
to.
That at any point in time.
Does a field trip sound good?
We're trying to organize a field trip. We'd love to have you.
Thank you.
Including 3-year-olds.
Of course.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
He's on.
Yes.
And I'll bring my train whistle.
I'm settled.
I want to sidetrack for just 1 second. If you look at an average of a cost of $1.5 million per mile, part of the reason double tracking is very difficult is just because of the outright expense of 60 miles of track.
It's absolutely. And to end, our commitment, our railroad in all of Genesee and Wyoming, we're committed to working with communities, customers, and other stakeholders that we serve. We live in these communities. We we operate next to our neighbors, and so safety of the communities is vital to us. We are certain that we will continue to facilitate job growth in the safest, most environmental sensitive way possible for this beautiful state. I thank you for the time today, and if I'll entertain any questions that you might have.
Yes, Representative Lively.
So I have a question, and I'm not trying to put some on the spot, but I'd like to just explore a little bit more safety. And I'm thinking of safety from the standpoint of crossings and the general public.
Correct.
And in my area, not my specific community, my area, there's a big conversation and debate about horns and the railroads using horns. Now, so I guess I'm just trying to understand. We've got crossbars. We've got a lot of, you know, bells that ring. We have a lot of different things, but then there's also the horns. So is there... I mean, is there data that shows us a direct link between the railroads sounding the horn before they go across the crossings versus the other things that are there, that the reason they use the horns, or what else is behind? I guess I'm trying to, and I'm not against the horns, understand, but I'm just trying to understand the issue.
Well, I think what I'd start by saying, and you can chime in, Kevin, is that, you know, typically the states determine what sort of protections we have on crossings, right? And we fulfill that requirement per each crossing. Train horn, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, we're governed by federal regulations on blowing at crossings. And it's not something that, you know, we can deviate. I get many phone calls throughout the day thinking that our engineers are blowing the horn excessively loud. And there's a certain decibel that has to be done. And there's also a certain amount of time. And the signal, the two longs, the short, and the long. And they're required to do that as many times as necessary. So, you know, that you do have this system of quiet zones. Mm-hmm. The UP has them through Salem, but it shifts the burden of liability to the cities or to the citizens from the railroad. And so generally a lot of people, and it's very expensive, don't want to do that. But it's a federal regulation that is not open to much interpretation, but depending on speed when that engineer is required to start. Speed and distance are required to start blowing that horn.
The train horn rule. The train horn rule.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you. Mr. Parkinson, thank you for being here today.
Thank you. I can stay here. Okay. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, but I trust that my written testimony has been provided.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's in Olds. Thank you.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Scott Parkinson, president of ARG Transportation Services. We're headquartered in Eugene. We're a multimodal transportation solutions provider. We have a couple divisions, one of which is railroad services. In the railroad services, we have the San Pedro and Southwestern Railroad, which we lease and operate from our friends at Union Pacific Railroad. And then, of course, here in Oregon, the Coos Bay Rail Link, which we manage and operate on behalf of the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. So I appreciate the opportunity to come here and testify because I get to do one of the things I love to do most, which is brag on the story of the Coos Bay Rail Link. I think you all are probably pretty familiar with the story. And in my testimony, I've referenced a piece that the port put out that chronicles the history of bringing the line back to life and all that. So I think what you really want to hear today is how we're doing today. So I'm here to tell you the Coos Bay Rail Link is healthy and open for business today. We access every bit of the railroad going almost every day to all the customers that are resident on the railroad. So we're doing great. We are a going concern and a happening railroad. The performance recently has been really interesting to watch, the sort of ramp up from no carloads. Okay, well, 20 carloads in October of 2011 when we first started our very first month of operation.
Mr. Parkinson, I might stop you. We have new members on our committee who might not be familiar with the actual how the line was acquired and how you ended up operating it. You might just take a moment and explain it.
So I'll try to give the Reader's Digest, yes, ma'am,
the quick
Reader's
version.
Digest version, because it was a process of some 6 or 8 years rallied by the members of the community down in southwestern Oregon, supported by your public officials, and then the commercial users that were lost without their rail access. To put it briefly, the rail line from Eugene down to Coos Bay and beyond was embargoed on short notice, leaving a lot of shippers without their rail service. As we've all acknowledged, the sort of commodities we're running on rail, and if you know the topography getting down to Coos Bay. It's tough roads. It really stranded a lot of shippers and, more importantly, made a port almost unviable without that rail access. So a long and really exciting story of which we are just ecstatic to have been a part of, bringing the railroad back to life with gaining public support through all sorts of public and incentive monies. The port went out and selected an operator. We were fortunate to be chosen as that operator. Then we started the railroad back in 2011. So 2011, October, 20 whole carloads that year. 2012, about 2,500 carloads. 2014, about 5,000 carloads. Last year, about 7,500. So, you know, we added 2,500 a year. Wow. 45-degree angle, linear growth in the last 3 years. Been really, 7,500, I guess, pales a little in comparison to a million and a quarter. But let me tell you, we scrap and scrape for every single one of those carloads, and we're real proud of every one of those 7,500.
So can you swing by and pick up some cars and,
yeah. Well,
and Representative Lively's district?
Go for any carload we can get out of there. Yes, sir. Anyway, that's the story to date. I've noted that we've recently gone to five-day-a-week service, which doesn't sound like so much a deal from 2 or 3 day a week, but what it means is we're going every day. So a train is running the entire length of the railroad every day, going into interchange in Eugene with the Union Pacific. As I said, we interchange there in Eugene. We're open all the way from there down to the plywood plant at Coquille and all the customers in between, mills, let's put it, you know, mostly forest products currently. So we did touch on the resurrection of the line that entailed remediating a lot of deferred maintenance. We have done that through the good graces of a lot of public funding. There had been just years and years of deferred maintenance on the line, and we undertook a project, and you know, I think we're a pretty darn good story of the public-private partnership, because we couldn't get the public money. The port got the public money. We interacted and worked hand in glove with them to administer that money, conduct those projects. We did it while we were building that fledgling traffic. So we're doing these repairs under traffic, as they call it. And it was really, really an impressive thing how we, honestly, we feel like we squeezed every last cent out of the bucks we got to, in the most efficient way to get the railroad back to operation. As I said, all the track has been resurfaced. All the track infrastructure is sort of brought up to level. We've addressed every bridge problem that was keeping us from running, remediated the problems in the bridges that were basically, or at the end of the day, the reason the railroad did shut down. So we've fixed those to where we can operate. But the point I do want to make is we're not done. I mean, we've got over 150 water crossings, and we will never be done. those bridges, we're working on priorities. They go priority 1, 2, 5, and we're working all the 1s and 2s. And in the meantime, other ones are aging. And we don't have a whole super heavy volume on there, so we're not beating them up to the degree the Class 1 will. But I guess my appeal to the committee, and just one thought I'd like to leave today, is that we're not done. We're going to continue to require all the help we can get. And as I said, we are going concerned. What we're really trying to do is to live to fight another day and get that anchor tenant that's going to do export through the port, diversify our customer base, build infrastructure on the railroad, help develop the port down there, and then more will follow. Then we'll get off the public trough so much, and we have the commercial users, the kinds that can really support that kind of infrastructure. Having said that, we don't rest on our laurels, and we're here to do everything we can. We have a few self-help projects underway. Last year, we built a siding West Eugene, very end of our part of the railroad, but it's in the Eugene environs on the west side, and I can corroborate $400,000 to build about 2,000 miles of siding. So it's not inexpensive stuff, but it's in, it's ready to be used. The port was able to finance it. We're repaying that through the business that we'll generate there, and we're working on that now.
Mr. Parkinson, I think I'll correct for the record that 2,000 miles probably wasn't built. It was 2,000 feet.
Well, I guess you're right.
We would love to have it be 2,000 miles. That would be awesome.
2,000 feet, 30 to 40 rail cars. Okay, that's
thank you.
Really more like it. Yes, ma'am, thanks.
It's okay.
What we're calling a multi-use facility at Millington, south of Coos Bay. This is a concept we recently come up with, and it's designed to be what we call a team track, open to the public, expand the reach of that railroad. Okay, if you think about a railroad, you can only serve the people that have rail into their facility. Well, we want to make it available to more users in the region, and a team track / multi-use facility like that will do that. So that's in the works down. I mean, it's kind of conceptual still, but that's in the works down in the south end of the railroad. And then another thing we're hoping to do is, you all may or may not recall, but a lot of really world-class infrastructure was built on the North Spit going out along the lower bay of Coos Bay. And I mean, this stuff is heaviest rail, concrete ties, and then essentially one customer at the very end. We're thinking of adding some more track to both the lead and then as well as this customer's facility to encourage more volume out of them, use that infrastructure. And those, again, are just examples of self-help projects we're undertaking these days. And I'd just like to close with an invitation to the field trip initiative. We're going to have a barbecue down in Coos Bay on Friday, celebrating 900 days of safety-free, or accident-free safety celebration on Friday, a barbecue at
Congratulations.
Midday.
Congratulations.
Thank you, ma'am.
Wonderful. Yes. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much for your presentation. It's just fantastic to see business continuing to pick up, and thanks for what you've done for the community down there. You talked about the growth, and I'm just wondering, at what point do you reach profitability is probably the wrong word, but even sustainability in terms of operation and potential. I don't know what the long-term plans are for if it's offloading it back to a private company or what the where are you headed in terms of breaking even and potentially returning this back to the private sector or not?
Okay. Well, Chair McHugh and Vice Chair Davis, we're not a charitable organization. We've been profitable since very early on, but due to the good graces of all that public incentive and stimulus money I was mentioning. So I'm not sure I could put a benchmark, but I do know that the way that's going to happen is some significant exporter is going to come in here. When we do that, and this is what we don't do unit trains now, but we would. To do unit trains, we got to have, if you think of it, places to pass each other coming and going. So long passing sidings. The tunnels right now are a constraining factor. We can only do a single layer of international shipping containers, for example. So we might need to improve the tunnels there. And all that's going to really be driven by some commercial operator. I'm convinced those economic forces will coincide. Again, as my esteemed colleague from Union Pacific put it, that makes sense for the community, for us as the railroad, and for the customer. It's going to make sense for them. So we're doing fine now. We're going to continue to be that going concern, but we're going to need some help to keep remediating all this deferred maintenance.
Thank you.
I think I might want to clarify something, that the Port of Coos Bay owns the line, but ARG Trans is hired as the operator, so they are a private business that's operating it.
I apologize. Yeah, yeah. I meant the ownership of the line. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd also draw attention, when you saw the picture of the tunnel on the Siskiyou line, there are a number of those tunnels all through the Coast Range. And when they built them, in fact, a lot of the tunnels on the Coos Bay Rail Line were built in 1912, 1914. And they built the inside of the tunnel at a higher level, and they rounded the portals. And some of them just need to notch the portals for double-stack cars. It's not that the tunnel itself is the constraining factor. It's the beautiful portals that they built, that creates the problem. Thank you so much. We're just delighted that you're here. I think to note that the infrastructure that short lines are operating on in Oregon is old infrastructure. It was built way back when, and that's part of the challenge that we face is the maintenance on those that have been deferred, and now we need to come forward and continue to upgrade them so we can continue to run to service our shippers and service our businesses and our manufacturers and our ports. So we appreciate all the good work that you do. It's not easy, and it's an uphill slog, but there's hope at the end, light at the end of the tunnel, as they say. Any other questions for our short line operators?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. We appreciate you being here. We have Skip Tarr next on our panel. And there's written testimony in OLIS. We had one other rail line that we had hoped to showcase today down in Lakeview, I believe, and they're not able to be here today. They had to stay down south and weren't able to travel up today, so we're missing one, and my apologies for that, but they just weren't able to get out of town today. Their testimony is on OLIS, however, if you'd like to take a look at it. Mr. Tarr, thank you so much for being here today.
Representative McEwen and members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Skip Tarr. I'm the owner and president of Tarr Terminals Incorporated and Tarr LLC. We're a small business, and the nature of our business is chemical distribution. Our primary function is to procure commodity hazardous chemicals, get them to our market, and then customize them for local regional manufacturers' needs. We're a value-added operation. Tarr was a Connect Oregon grant recipient of $1,040,000 in Connect Oregon 4. That project, that $1 million, helped close the gap of a $9 million project that I had started back in 06. And with that grant, I was able to go forward and get the project going in 2013. It was completed in August of 2014. The project, what it did, the company's over 50 years old, and it had the growth in the last 20 years has occurred through rail car procurement, but our facility was not on rail. It did not have access to rail. So we worked through a team track, which then required transloading to our trucks, moving it into our facility, and then from that production facility, moving it again to a warehouse facility. So the aim of the project was to get everything onto one piece of property to eliminate all the handling. From an efficiency standpoint, obvious efficiencies, and from a safety, environmental, and just in traffic safety standpoint. By doing that, the company annually took 1,000 hazardous material shipments off the roads in Portland, basically traveling from the team track out by the Expo Center along the Columbia down to just the east end of the Fremont Bridge. Very busy corridor.
Mr. Tarr, may I interrupt you? Can you explain what a team track is for those who might not understand that term?
Yeah, a team track was just brought up earlier. It's an area where the public, so to speak, those without rail, can send rail cars and then access their product that way to bring it into their own facility. So we pay, in our case, it was a Peninsula Terminal, PT, for spots there for our rail cars to sit. So.
Thank you.
So the project was to eliminate that, to bring rail right to our site, and to be able to offload rail cars right into a much larger tank farm that then is tied directly into our production facility and our truck loading facility. The efficiencies are obvious from an environmental standpoint. We now, every time a car is accessed, it's in a contained area. So if an unfortunate incident should occur, the whole spill would be contained. Prior to that, in team track, that was not the case. Although I'm proud to report that we never had any at the team track because of our operations. Just the elimination of that many trucks off the road was an impact to the community, to the highways. The company, just step back a little bit more about what the company does, because there's an economic impact as well. This will help us retain 40 jobs in the Portland area. We're a company of 70 employees. We have an operation in Phoenix, Arizona as well. Because of this enhanced facility, we're right now in the process of moving jobs from Phoenix to Portland. And then prior to that, it's just the long-term for our company to stay in this business in this area was that needed to have this type of operation, or really its long-term viability wasn't there. You know, I'm pleased to tell you with the Connect Oregon project, TAR is here for another 50 plus years because it's with a state-of-the-art facility. I guess that pretty much sums up what the message I wanted to get across. I am obviously in support of the Connect Oregon from a small business perspective. Any questions?
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just have a couple of questions. I'm just trying to understand your business. So you say here commodity chemical solvents value added. So you bring in...
I'll give you one example I like that we're proud of. We've had a lot of success with this. A commodity chemical that a lot of people are familiar with, isopropyl alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
our company brings in 30,000 gallon rail cars of isopropyl alcohol from a refinery in the Gulf area.
Uh-huh.
We bring it in and we then break it down into a lot of different forms for package styles. But you know, in particular, though, we'll take that, we've developed technology to clean up that product further, to take trace metals out of it. Mm. So now it's suitable for the semiconductor industry to use.
Because
the primary, outside of Intel, we supply pretty much all the other semiconductor manufacturers in Oregon. It's really a great example because without our company doing that, those jobs were either in Texas or in California. So our desire and ability to step out in a facility of this nature, I'm not going to claim success for the semiconductor industry in Oregon, but we're just we've helped it a little bit, and we've brought a lot of jobs here that wouldn't be otherwise.
Representative Lyman.
Thank you. So are you the only one providing these types of services?
We're the only privately held company in the Northwest region. My competitors are multi-billion dollar companies that operate companies like Univar, Brentag, very fine companies. But so they do it on a level that we do as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not as tied to the local economy.
The local,
so like the example with the isopropyl alcohol for the semiconductor industry, that's not something that they get involved with.
Sure.
So,
thank you very much.
So, Mr. Tarr, where would be the next closest facility similar to yours in the Western United States? How unique are you?
We're extremely unique, and there hasn't been a facility like this built in the last 25 years, mm-hmm. I believe, on the West Coast. There's a couple in Los Angeles that were built about that far back.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very unique in terms of our primary hazard is flammability. And so everything within our warehouse and our production facilities and at the rail offloading is geared towards preventing fire, one, but two, if everything fails, stopping a fire.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unique from just the handling of flammable products. But it's further unique in the value-added functions that we undertake.
Sure. Can you give us a sense of how many commodities you handle in a given year?
It's tough to say. We probably, just in our 34-tank farm, there's probably 18 different chemical products in there. But then we bring in piggyback quantities from overseas and from other parts of the country, so that all together we might have 40.
Okay. And are they sourced in the United States, or is anything sourced offshore and brought in by vessel?
There's primarily sourced. Vast majority, high percentage of our product comes from the United States. But there are more and more we are sourcing from Asia, through the ports.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much for taking time to come down and testify today. The Connect Oregon project, is that located on your Columbia Boulevard location?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Very interesting. I'm sensing a lot of field trips.
We may need
today.
Another field trip, yes.
We're going to have a whole week of field trips.
You're all very welcome. We hosted several legislative since August after it was completed. And so anytime you're in Portland, just give me a call.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes. Representative McLean.
Well, the only question I had was really for everyone, and it was the connection that you folks have had with the Transportation Commission. And I just wanted to give anybody a chance to talk about the transportation package that the state of Oregon is hoping to produce in this legislature, and if there's anything that you think is important or if you've read the report from the Transportation Commission and what you thought of it. And it doesn't have to be today, but I just think it's important. Transportation, like freight and business rail, I think is extremely important and should have a place somewhere, you know, in the dialogue of a overall comprehensive transportation package.
We intend to make sure that that is a piece of this conversation, so I appreciate your acknowledging that. Anybody want to step forward?
Well, before I step away,
sure.
I'm not sure it's really the place for this, but as was brought up about the impact of the Hanjin and the port situation in Portland, I mean, I can tell you, as of a week ago, I had about $500,000 of inventory that I couldn't get my hands on. So, and that's paid for.
Right.
And so that, you know, that's a pain that we're enduring. And I can't get those products to my customers
right.
who need it. I'm also starting to hear about some of my customers who can't get their manufactured products out of the port. And so I'm kind of anticipating a slowdown here. So I'm not sure what jurisdiction, how far it reaches, but anything you can do to help resolve that would be, I think, huge for Portland.
Right. Thank you so much. Ms. Roberts?
Madam Chair, Sue Robert with Union Pacific Railroad. I want to answer your question really briefly. I think that you're talking about the transportation package as we all envision it happening this session. And at Union Pacific, BNSF, PNW, the short lines, have been an active participants in the Oregon Transportation Forum, which is the group that's been working on it. We understand from the rail and that in order for us to do well, the whole system has to do well. So we are committed to making sure that every mode is well cared for in Oregon. And I think Representative Davis, who's been on that group as well at the Oregon Transportation Forum, would say that we've all been participating and trying to work towards something. So I'm sure you'll hear from us in the near future. Of course, Connect Oregon and the multimodal piece is really important to us, but the whole system has to work well together.
Thank you. It wasn't that I didn't believe that you were. It's just that I hadn't seen you on the other presentation.
Right.
So it was just important for me to ask.
Right. Thank you so much for acknowledging that. And I will draw attention, and Mr. Burley, I'm not going to put you on the spot and invite you up unless you would choose to, but we have another short line owner, in essence, in the room. Gilcrest Lumber has it's called Klamath Northern. Klamath Northern, it's a 12-mile short line that connects Gilcrest, the mill in Gilcrest, in Chemult. Short lines can be of varying lengths, and this is a small one, but a very critical, important piece of infrastructure for that particular business. So thank you for sitting in with us today. I'm happy to acknowledge that all of these are important pieces.
I might point out, Madam Chair, Mr. Burley was also vice chair of this committee in 2004. When I was staffing this committee.
Oh, welcome back.
<Very good.
laughs> Still interested in rail, I see. Anything for the good of the order this afternoon? Comments? Thank you all so much for being here today. It's an important topic, and it's important to the state of Oregon, certainly important to the work that we're trying to do on transportation this year, and I'm very, very grateful for your time. And on that note, we will close the hearing. Very grateful for your time. And on that note, we will close the hearing.